Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, it's a special week here for the world of us. They don't even know it yet. We're going to release a regular episode, which you know, because you're currently listening to it.
Yep.
And then a little later in the week, we're going to release a bonus episode about the 1 year anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We are going to talk with a bunch of smart people, some you know, some you're maybe meeting for the first time, about the state of the war, politics in Russia, life for civilians in Ukraine. So be on the lookout. Sometime Friday, I think.
Yeah. And I actually really learned a lot just in doing that episode. So hopefully you will too.
Ben's already been getting to work on it.
It's important to pull the camera back and take a look at how things are. So
it's been a long year. It's been a long year. Today, we're going to lead with President Biden's surprise trip to Kyiv. I still don't know whether it's Kyiv or Kyiv. Every time I see an American, they say Kyiv. I hear Ukrainians saying Kyiv. I don't even know anymore. It doesn't matter.
You can't get that Slavic intonation in your voice.
I know. I'm just not good at it. Yeah. We'll talk about Biden's trip, his speech in Poland, the demise of a very critical arms control treaty, and growing U.S. concern that China might be providing lethal military aid to Russia. We're also going to talk about a major political change in Scotland, a worrisome report about Iran's nuclear program, Israel's growing hacking for hire industries, amazing reporting about that, and a quick run through of some big stories that we're watching, AI gone wild, and the latest sad news about the very sad man that is Mike Pompeo. I had to throw this one in. I caught a little something late.
I don't know what it is. I really don't.
Yeah. And then this is my favorite thing to do in the show is just surprise you with one thing and just get that natural.
I mean, if it's about Mike Pompeo or Jared Kushner, it's usually
an explosion. And then Ben, Congressman Ro Khanna was in this building, in this seat last week. Is he in Taiwan as we speak?
Yes, he's in Taiwan. So he was on his way to Taiwan the next day. So we talked about China. He's on this select committee that the Republicans have set up to, investigate China or something.
Get to the bottom of China.
Yeah, but we talked about the Biden's China policy, Ro's focus on winning the manufacturing competition and
win the future.
Win the future. Yeah, I was going to say that. And how should progressives think about standing up to China on all these things that we care about without it tipping into a full Cold War, including the issue of Taiwan. So well-timed visit from Congressman Ro Khanna.
Yeah, he's an unusually smart and thoughtful person on foreign policy.
Yeah, if you want to kind of know where the kind of the thinking is around a certain kind of progressive politics domestically, internationally, like he's a good thought leader to track.
You also watched me go 0-for-2 in trying to make a joke about how he was going to endorse in the California Senate primary. I made a similar joke when Karen Bass, the mayor of Los Angeles, was in the building. No one thinks it's funny in California.
Yeah, just didn't land.
They don't want to touch it.
Yeah.
They're just like, get out of my face, you loser.
I'm just putting this off. Yeah.
Like, I hate you. Okay. So, Ben, let's start with President Biden's surprise trip to Kyiv. To pull this trip off, President Biden snuck out of Washington, D.C. at 4:15 a.m. on Sunday morning. This was after a meal at the Red Hen, but sadly it was not the same Red Hen, not the civility Red Hen. Very bummed. They refueled in Germany. Then they flew to southeastern Poland. From there, President Biden drove an hour to the Poland-Ukraine border, hopped on a train, rode 10 hours to Kyiv, arriving at 8 a.m. Monday morning. I am exhausted just thinking about that itinerary. Thank God the guy loves train rides.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty unique train ride.
That's a cool train ride. Very cool picture of Jake Sullivan and President Biden on the train preparing a speech. So Biden gets to Kyiv. He visits the presidential palace. They go to the U.S. embassy. They walked around the streets a bit. They held a joint press conference, him and Zelensky. And Biden announced $500 million in additional military aid. The White House told reporters that this trip had been in the works for months, but that President Biden made the final decision on the Friday before his visit. Other presidents have visited war zones like Iraq or Afghanistan, including President Obama. But in those cases, there is a massive U.S. military footprint on the ground to protect you, to do all the logistics. Biden's trip was unique in that Kyiv faces ongoing Russian military attacks. There's no U.S. military footprint. And it was very risky. And that risk was underscored when air raid sirens started going off as Biden and Zelensky were strolling around. The White House said they gave the Russians a heads up a few hours before the visit for, quote, deconfliction purposes. That basically means don't do something stupid and start World War III. The conversation with Zelensky focused on future military campaigns, Ukraine's request for weapon systems, and I'm sure a lot of other stuff that we don't know. So, Ben, there were reports over the weekend, even on Sunday, about how Biden's team had all but ruled out a trip to Ukraine. I read that and I thought to myself, honestly, like, good? You know, the downside risk of something bad happening is so high that, like, I could almost not make the case for the upside. But, you know, having watched it now, credit to President Biden. I mean, and he didn't go to, like, Lviv or Western Ukraine. He went to the Capitol because he thought the symbolism was that important. I'm just curious, like, what you made of the trip and what you imagine the conversations with Secret Service were like to pull this off.
Yeah. Well, I guess just on the logistics side of it, having, you know, I used to have to be in the planning on our trips to Afghanistan, less so Iraq because I was in earlier in the administration. But there are a couple of hard things here. One is the Secret Service would probably say no, just we have to be overruled to do this, which is actually fair, like, because what they're giving you is an assessment, you know, about, you know, the difficulties of assuring a certain level of protection.
And this isn't a hard assessment. It's like, yeah, there were 32 missiles launched yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. So, you have to assume that this was them saying, you know, but if you tell, to the credit of the Secret Service, if you tell them, well, we're doing this anyway, we just have to make it work, then they do all kinds of evaluations and they're in touch with all kinds of people. That's the first thing that's hard. The second thing that's hard is, it's hard to kind of read in the other government. Like, you know, I think the backstory that we'll never know is kind of when they told the Ukrainians, or they may have told Zelensky, but told him he couldn't tell anybody. Because what you don't want is it out on the transom for days or weeks, you know, in a non-secure communications environment, right? So point is, it's incredibly hard to pull off logistically, and it asks a lot of any president to kind of fly in the middle of the night, not on Air Force One, then you're on a train. Which gets to the value of it. I mean, I really do think this was a powerful symbolic thing to do 1 year into the war in so many ways. I mean, what I couldn't help but think is that I'm sure that Putin thought he'd be going to Kyiv, right? And actually, there were reports in the early days of the war that some of the Russian units were literally planning, like, parades and stuff.
They found, like, their vehicles, and they were full of uniforms, not weapons, because they thought they were going to have a dress parade.
Exactly. And so I'm sure in Putin's fantasy, you know, he would be in Kyiv before Joe Biden, certainly, right?
And greeted as liberators.
It didn't exactly turn out that way. And so I think it's a sign of how much, you know, expectations have been upended 1 year into this war, that an American president can visit, like, a free, albeit under assault, Kyiv. You know, it sends a message of you know, staying power, a message politically to European capitals and to Washington that, hey, we're in this thing.
Yeah. Many European leaders have gone to Kyiv as well.
They've gone too, and that's been really important.
You know, Boris Johnson, like, got a place there, I think.
Well, and the EU leadership has cycled through there. But this is good. It's a reminder that, you know, there's an orientation from Ukraine to the West that is deepening, right? It doesn't, I mean, I think it was great. Some of the commentary, you would have thought that, you know, Putin was going to come out and surrender because of the visit. You know, there's a little bit, it got cranked, you know, like everything in the Ukraine commentary, when it gets cranked beyond a 10 of 10.
The Atlantic had what I think I could only describe as a collective literary orgasm.
Yeah. So all to
the
good.
Elliot Cohen is like, the war is over. What are you talking about, man?
All to the good, but the it still is what it is.
What do you make of telling the Russians in advance? Like, on the one hand, it makes a lot of sense, but I mean, that's a tough call.
That's an interesting call. I do think at the end of the day, you know, there's still a sense that either side is controlling some amount of escalation, right?
Yeah.
And they just had to make the calculation that it was riskier to not tell them and risk just some random bombardment of, you know, Ukrainian infrastructure that happens to coincide with Joe Biden's visit, that was a riskier bet than thinking that if you told the Russians that they'd somehow take a shot at Joe Biden.
Yeah.
I mean, and that would have been, you know, definitely the right call.
Unthinkable scenario. Yeah, exactly. Who do you think delivers that message? CIA Director Bill Burns?
I don't know. I was, you know, like the ambassador,
Jake?
There's still an ambassador there, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you might get the ambassador probably wouldn't be notified of the trip in advance either. And so you're calling that guy and saying, hey, by the way, can you tell these guys something?
Or, two things.
Yeah.
One's urgent.
Yeah. Or, but you could also, I'm sure there are channels through the intelligence community or the military. Actually, what they may have done is multiple channels, you know, to make sure that the message got through to everybody.
That's a very good point. And Biden didn't even get to take Air Force One DC. They took an Air Force C-32 plane. It's a modified Boeing 757, I guess, just to, like, fly a little more under the radar, a little lighter footprint. I mean, it's not as odd. What it says Air Force One on the side, you know, the jig is kind of up.
Yeah.
I remember there was a trip where somehow it got out in advance that Obama was going to either Iraq or Afghanistan.
Afghanistan.
And I was in the West Wing. And I saw the report and I like ran down to the sit room and I was like, you've got to alert them. And they're like, all right, kid, we got this covered. Because actually, I think they turn off all communications on the plane, so there's no signature.
They turn off all the lights too. So I remember I was in the plane and, you know, there was some freak out of like, you know, oh, should we turn back or something? But the reality, as you say, is that in Afghanistan, you're landing at Bagram Air Base, you know, so the real risk is just during your descent.
Yeah, it's like one Stinger missile.
Yeah, exactly. And so they turn off all the lights on the plane, and that is creepy because, like, you're landing in the middle of the night, there are no lights on. And
corkscrew landing.
It's not that dramatic, but it, you are aware that, like, you know, this isn't, you know, you're not flying into Paris here.
Yeah. So, I mean, amazing trip. So President Biden, I guess, took a 10-hour train ride back to Poland, where he met with President Duda of Poland. He delivered a speech at the Warsaw Castle. Here is a clip of some of the sound from President Biden in Ukraine and his speech.
1 year ago, the world was bracing for the fall of Kyiv. Well, I just come from a visit to Kyiv, and I can report Kyiv stands strong. Kyiv stands proud. It stands tall. And most important, it stands free. When President Putin ordered his tanks to roll into Ukraine, he thought we would roll over. He was wrong. Putin no longer doubts the strength of our coalition. But he still doubts our conviction. He doubts our staying power. He doubts our continued support for Ukraine. He doubts whether NATO can remain unified. But there should be no doubt. Our support for Ukraine will not waver. NATO will not be divided, and we will not tire. Putin's craven lust for land and power will fail, and the Ukrainian people's love for their country will prevail. No one can turn away their eyes from the atrocities Russia is committing against the Ukrainian people. It's abhorrent. It's abhorrent. This war is never a necessity. It's a tragedy. President Putin chose this war. Every day the war continues is his choice. He could end the war with a word. It's simple. If Russia stopped invading Ukraine, it would end the war. If Ukraine stop defending itself against Russia would be the end of Ukraine.
President Biden taking on a lot of arguments there, including kind of accidentally President Putin directly, because there was this dueling speeches thing happening as Putin delivered a 100-minute stem winder, which is actually quite short by his standards. We will cover that speech in the political situation in Russia in a lot more depth in the bonus episode that comes out later this week. But a big headline from Putin's speech is he announced that he is suspending compliance with the New START treaty. The New START treaty is an arms control treaty that limits the number of strategic nuclear weapons deployed by the U.S. and Russia to 1,550 per country. Obama negotiated it in 2011. It was extended recently and supposed to be in force until 2026. But as we discussed in a recent episode, the State Department said last month that Russia has refused to comply with the treaty. They won't allow U.S. inspectors to their military sites, and it's been a mess. Putin did say he was fully pulling out of New START. And my understanding is that Russia has not broken the limits yet by deploying a bunch of additional weapons. But if that happened, it would be very bad. So, Ben, I saw a friend of the pod, arms control expert Joe Cerencione, suggest that this is really probably part of a broader effort by Putin to stoke fears of nuclear use and use that threat to continue to deter Europe, to deter more aid. Do you buy that? Do you think this is something bigger? Like, what do you make of this moment to pull out of, not pull out, but suspend START?
I mean, I think it is a sign of how volatile and dangerous the situation is, in the sense that we will have no arms control regime with Russia for the first time that I can remember.
Yeah.
Like, even in the Cold War, we had nuclear arms agreements. And just so people know, again, it's not just the limitations. It's like the verification measures, right? You can see where missiles are deployed.
And also worth noting that Trump, Mike Pompeo, John Bolton pulled out of a bunch of other arms control.
Well, that's the thing. The U.S. has kind of been a serial, you know, pulling out of arms control. Anytime John Bolton is in government, we seem to pull out of a new arms control agreement. But this is a whole new world, with a world without arms control, nuclear arms control. And, Sure, I think Putin's motives might be, I think Joe may be right, that like he wants to play into the fear of nuclear escalation. That is scary.
Oh, yeah. The most scary thing.
even if that is the gambit he's running, and I think that is accurate. He wants it in the back of our heads. It does just point to the fact that we're in this kind of period of escalation with Russia where we don't quite know where it's going to end, And I think, the speech, Biden's speech, hit all the marks that you'd want to hit on the anniversary. You need to remind people what this is all about. You need to kind of go back to the core of the issue. I think every word was true. And one of the challenges, it's not Joe Biden's fault, is he's right. Putin could end the war. But you know what? Putin's not going to end the war. Like, that's not going to happen, And we just have to kind of acclimate ourselves to this kind of open-ended reality that we're in, where the guy who's in charge of Russia is not going to submit to reason or even pressure on this thing. And so therefore, you're going to be in the state of trying to help the Ukrainians win while trying to control for escalation. And those two goals are not always, comfortably aligned.
Yeah, yeah. And, and just sort of live with the reality that, we might have no arms control agreements and be in a place where there's basically very little to no diplomatic relationship between the U.S. and Russia. I mean, we were able to get this message to them about Biden's visit, so I guess that's good news, but not great. The other thing that happened over the weekend, Ben, was Secretary of State Tony Blinken was on all the Sunday shows from the Munich Security Summit in Germany. There, he met with his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. They discussed a number of topics, including the Chinese surveillance balloon. Sadly, it doesn't sound like Tony got us that heartfelt apology that we all wanted. But Tony also reiterated concerns laid out previously by President Biden and Vice President Harris, most recently in her speech in Munich as well, about China possibly providing lethal military aid to China. Here's a clip of Tony from Meet the Press.
I also had an opportunity, because we're here in Munich, as you know, focused primarily on Russia's ongoing aggression against Ukraine, to share our very real concerns about China's support for Russia in that war. And what we've seen over the past years is, of course, some political and rhetorical support, even some non-lethal support, but we are very concerned that China is considering providing lethal support to Russia in its aggression against Ukraine, and I made clear that that would have serious consequences in our relationship.
So, Ben, it seems like they must be seeing something, intelligence, something somewhere, that suggests that China is thinking about, considering, preparing to do this, because the rhetoric is ratcheting up and they're going more public with it. What do you think's going on, and what do you think the consequences would be if the U.S. learned that the Chinese were supplying drones like Iran or artillery shells like North Korea?
Well, clearly they're seeing something because, they went out of their way to raise this. Tony Blinken did, Kamala Harris did in Munich. And the Chinese kind of reacted, with a mix of denial and anger.
I think Wang Yi's in Russia right now.
Yeah. Well, so. What I think is they must have seen something concerning, and we saw in the run up to Russia, they're not afraid to kind of, say something that they learned through intelligence publicly if they feel like it meets their objectives. Look, first of all, they're probably frustrated just with what China's already been doing, right? Which is on purchases of energy and sanctions and things like that. China is still like a main backstop to Russia and a lifeline to Russia. And so, they're probably already speaking from a position of frustration. They also knew that he would be going on to Russia. They may want to get ahead of that, kind of shape that, the perception of that. But if this is real, if China is kind of considering backfilling Russia, this is hugely consequential because, number one, China obviously just has a lot more resources than like an Iran or North Korea, the other countries that might be suppliers to Russia. Number two, a lot of our sanctions are meant to kind of cut Russia off from its capacity to backfill certain technologies, to keep their kind of, factories running, to keep their military industrial complex going. And China presumably could make up some of that, in addition to just the amount of small arms and weapon stocks like what we're supplying to Russia. China stepping in would be huge. But then most importantly, like, China's never been involved in a European conflict like this. It really would be a huge shift in Chinese foreign policy to say we're taking a side in the Russia-Ukraine war.
Yeah.
And it may be that China hasn't decided to do that, but just the fact that there's indications or the fact that the Russians are trying really hard may have led the administration to want to get out ahead of it. But this is definitely one to watch.
This is serious stuff.
Yeah.
And look, just to close the balloon loop, hopefully for the last time, there was a report last week where some people in the U.S. intel community said that they think the Chinese spy balloon was actually supposed to surveil Guam, but got blown off course by weird, strong, abnormal winds. There was some interesting background in these reports about how Chinese officials at first, you know, they got demarched, which means you like summon in the ambassador in Washington. Yeah. They didn't respond for a couple of days because no one knew what was going on. Then there was a suggestion that maybe the balloon operators sped it up in some way, but didn't use a self-destruct mechanism. There's a lot of like speculative reporting out there. The Pentagon has also been searching for the other, almost certainly not Chinese balloons that they shot down.
Yeah.
So far, no luck. Also searching for a balloon, Ben, is the Northern Illinois Bottle Cap Balloon Brigade, or NIBBB, which is an amateur balloon hobbyist club who had their balloon go missing off the coast of Alaska on February 10th, which is the same day an F-22 shot one down in the region. This is according to Aviation Week. The Pico balloons that the NIBBB hobbyists use cost between $12 and $180. The Sidewinder missiles that took it out potentially cost $436,000. So,
yeah,
again,
I think that, you know, like those three balloon shootdowns are were probably a bit like, you know, like the big guy at the bar, like gets surprised by like, you know, someone throws an object that hits him, and then he just starts wailing on people. like we were taking out like, you know, student projects with like Sidewinder missiles.
It's like poor high school kids. Yeah. There's some other balloon.
But I mean, we sent a message to the Chinese, like, we'll be taking down your balloons. So I guess that's the argument. Like we are deterring. We're in balloon deterrence zone here.
Big helium has been deterred.
Yeah.
Big news out of Scotland last week, Ben. So First Minister Nicola Sturgeon shocked everyone by announcing that she would step down. Sturgeon is the leader of the Scottish National Party. She's Scotland's longest-serving First Minister. And what's so surprising here is, you know, despite what Don Lemon might think, she's still very young. She's 52, which, you know, in the United States is like 40 years before your prime.
Yeah. Well like, said.
Like Jacinda Ardern, the former prime minister of New Zealand, who recently announced her retirement. Sturgeon said she was burnt out, exhausted, that felt like she'd become a polarizing figure after 8 years in the job. Sturgeon has been the leading figure in the Scottish independence movement and has been pushing for a second vote on Scottish independence after a failed effort in 2014. 37-year-old health minister Humza Yousaf is the front runner to replace her. That hasn't happened yet, but he's sort of leading the pack. He served in a number of key roles and became the first Muslim to be appointed to the Scottish government back in 2012. Ben, a lot of people are saying that the truly indelible moment from Sturgeon's career was her appearance on this show.
Yeah.
But anything else you think?
Many people are saying that.
Yeah. Anything else you think her legacy will be? What will be she be remembered as?
Well, I think, you know, obviously she consolidated a lot of support for independence. And she also kind of associated that party with a pretty progressive set of politics, too, which at times I think was hard, right? We covered the trans issue recently here. Where
she sort of battling with the UK government.
Yeah, but in, even within her own tent, I think, you know, she was both, and still is, a pro-independence politician, but also a very progressive politician. And, you know, I think the legacy is to consolidate a lot of support in Scotland behind her party, the SNP, which also hurt the Labour Party, the British Labour Party, right? Because they used to have a lot of support in Scotland, and obviously they were not pro-independence, and so then they lost some of their kind of working-class support in Scotland. So one of the things I'm looking for now is, does this weaken the SNP kind of overall and the momentum towards another independence vote? Does this actually end up strengthening Labour? Can they appeal to some of those voters? Or do those people kind of reconsolidate within the SNP? It'll just be interesting what this does to both the push for independence in Scotland, but also how Scotland interacts with broader UK politics, because she was such a big figure. And everything kind of ran, you know, a lot of this kind of ran through like her strategy. But, you know, we've probably not heard the last from her. And I think that in any case, there's going to be movements for Scottish independence periodically going forward, no matter what, you know?
Yeah. You know, in a sign of sort of where politics is going in this country, Donald Trump put out a statement taking a gigantic shot at her, criticizing her for being, you know, sort of a crazed leftist, which is, you know, clearly like what he cited in her in this statement was her decision to basically say that, hey, maybe transgender people can decide what gender they are. And, you know, like no one else should have a fucking say in it. But, you know, I'm sure what actually happened here is she probably like criticized his golf course or something.
Yeah. Well, that's it's actually both, I think, because she did like he wanted some licensing for golf courses. But I do think that like the global right saw that. That trans issue as just, you know, oh, like we'll join the culture war, you know?
Yeah.
Because Rishi Sunak jumped on it too. So,
yeah.
You know, it is what it is.
Well, I hope she, I don't know, I hope she sticks around in politics because she did seem like very good at the job.
Work moves fast. Every email, report, and proposal counts. That's where Grammarly comes in. It's your one place to think, write, and finish. Grammarly's AI agents help you find natural phrasing, fine-tune tone, and confidently write wherever you work. It's the premier writing tool that 93% of users trust to get more work done. In a world of generic AI, don't sound like everyone else. With Grammarly, you never will. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Spring Sale and get 35% off paints and stains March 13th through the 23rd. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Okay, so this is a disconcerting story, Ben, out of Iran. Bloomberg News reported that international atomic energy monitors detected uranium in Iran that was enriched to a level just short of weapons grade level. Uranium enrichment basically means you got a bunch of uranium, you mine it out of the ground, you use centrifuges and chemicals and other processes that I don't understand to concentrate it. 90% enriched uranium is considered weapons grade. The IAEA inspectors detected uranium enriched to 84% purity, so way too close for comfort. Bloomberg, this report said inspectors are trying to figure out if this was intentional, if it was an accident or some byproduct. Also, like having weapons-grade uranium doesn't mean you have a bomb. There's a bunch of additional steps, but it's not good. But, you know, as I was reading this yesterday, Ben, I saw two quotes from Tom Nides, who we worked with in government. Was he like the number two or three at the State Department?
Yeah, he was a deputy secretary of state.
Deputy secretary.
The management one.
Right. Yeah. Under Clinton, now he's the U.S. ambassador to Israel. So he was giving a speech. He said these two things. One, quote, as President Biden has said, we will not stand by and watch Iran get a nuclear weapon. Number two, he said, all options are on the table. So far, like kind of standard language on Iran. But here's where my ears perked up then. Quote, number three, Israel can and should do whatever they need to deal with, and we've got their back. Deal with Iran.
That's new.
That's new.
That wasn't certainly part of the talking points in the Obama years.
No. Go do whatever you want. And then he said, the Iranians are providing drones to Russia, and those drones are killing innocent Ukrainians. There is no chance today of us going back to the negotiating table. This was at the Conference of Presidents event in Jerusalem. So, I don't know. Maybe Tom was like riffing a little bit beyond policy. Maybe this is new policy we hadn't heard. But it's a worrisome setup here where you've got Iran at 84% enriched uranium and the U.S. seeming to shut down any diplomatic avenue to reduce tensions or get back into the JCPOA. Like, I get that there have been this big protest movement. We don't want to empower the regime during that, but the nuclear issue is still out there.
And this is the inevitable byproduct of pulling JCPOA. We don't have to relitigate that, but they couldn't do these things under the agreement. Look, I don't know why we would expect Iran to not move in this direction, the regime to move in this direction, when they feel so obviously besieged internationally and then are facing all these internal pressures. One course of action available to them is to say, like, well, our ultimate insurance policy is to finish the job in developing a nuclear weapon, or at least kind of getting close enough that we keep people guessing about what capability we have. I don't know what Tom Nides was signaling. I mean, in the Obama administration, we did say, you know, Israel should be able to defend itself by itself and we have your back and all the rest of it. But you try to avoid phrasing it in a way that suggested, you know, kind of a wink. And I don't think that's what he was doing. You know, I think it was probably more like the standard language. But to take World War III watch here, to people who've heard like my anxieties on this podcast, like a couple of things to watch, like China getting involved in the Ukraine war, right? is a little worrisome, because then suddenly you've got, you know, Russia and China together, and China involved in European conflict. And another flashpoint is this Iranian nuclear program. And do the Iranians try to get the nuclear weapon? The Israelis have been pretty clear that they would take military action to prevent that. There are these pots continue to boil up, right? And the direction continues to be, you know, in the escalatory direction.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah, I'm curious. Like, I didn't bring that up to pick on Tom. And maybe it was just, you know, sort of speaking extemporaneously.
No, but you're right to flag it, because it kind of speaks to, like...
You can interpret it as being, well, you know, if they kill a bunch of Iranian nuclear scientists, like, that's cool.
Yeah. Or, you know, remember we had that explosion that we talked about that took place in the middle of an Iranian city recently. I mean, you could start to see, short of, you know, a huge Israeli airstrike on Iran, just more action inside of Iran, more stuff blowing up, more...
Something happened in Syria this week.
Yeah.
Israelis blew up something in Syria this week. I don't know what it was. Speaking of Israel, so despite massive protests that we covered last week, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's government is still pushing through this plan to gut the power of Israel's judiciary. They completed sort of the first phase with sort of this reading in the Knesset. It'll still take a couple weeks to get finalized, but that's proceeding and we'll keep watching it. But we did want to recommend to readers just to check out this series of stories in Haaretz about an Israeli company that is basically an out-of-control CIA for hire. It's the best way to describe it, I think. They sell hacking services, the ability to plant fake materials on your opponents, fake social media accounts for propaganda campaigns, election disruption, campaigns to undermine election results. And the way we know about this is a bunch of journalists posed as a prospective client to sort of set up a sting operation. And this guy who called himself Jorge was pitching them on the services. And he said the company had meddled in 33 presidential level elections. He showed off his real-time access to private email and Telegram accounts used by cabinet ministers in Kenya and Mozambique. So their Gmails and their Telegram. And this is a company, they revealed, the reporters, that is run by two brothers based in Israel. These guys also ran a propaganda campaign in support of a man suspected of obstructing an investigation into the murder of 43 students in Mexico, I think is currently living in Israel. They ran a propaganda campaign against Gavin Newsom in California over a nuclear power plant. So they're just like completely out of control. Yeah. It's a long investigation. It's worth your time. We'll link to it in show notes. But I just, you know, we've talked about the NSO group before, which is this Israeli company that sold the Pegasus hacking software and spyware for hire. Then you read about this other company selling basically like coups for hire. And it does seem like this is the tip of the iceberg in an industry that is out of control. And seemingly a lot of these companies are based in Israel.
Yeah. And Biden administration, one of the very good things that they've done in this democracy space, small d democracy, is blacklisting NSO group, you know. Look, here's the problem. And I speak with the credibility of having myself been spied on by Black Cube, an outfit of former Mossad operatives who contacted my wife. Okay, so this and you know, had photographs of my apartment, and this is not pleasant, right?
No.
When this happens to you, the reality is that there is this large private intelligence industry, right? The worst Russian flavor it is the Wagner Group, which is clearly like a, you know, turned into like a death cult in Ukraine. But, you know, if you're an American intel veteran or a British intel veteran or an Israeli intel veteran and you have these skill sets, you know, you can make a lot of money on the marketplace with them, right? I think that that does put a burden on and a requirement on democracies to keep their arms around that and to put some guardrails around that and to regulate the shit out of that, you know? Because basically you are teaching people things like hacking and things like that when they're in your security services, and then they kind of continue it on the outside, you know, you have some responsibility for what you created. And clearly, like, the Israeli government is not putting a lot of guardrails around this stuff, right?
Right.
I mean, NSO Group is selling spyware all over the autocratic world, and these people appear to be meddling in, you know, all manner of countries and, you know, like the casual nature, Kenya, this is a major African country, you know, here's the Gmails of these guys. The U.S. intelligence community, I would hope, which has context in the Israeli intelligence community, is I hope that someone's like, what's going on over there? Because this is not, like, letting this like run rampant as a for-profit industry, which is what's happening now, is pretty fucking dangerous.
Yeah, and just in case anyone's like, it's hacking, it's propaganda. Like, in one of these conversations, they're talking about destabilizing Chad, the country, as a way of delaying the elections. Someone in the meeting suggested that there might be an explosion in a market in the capital, and that, like, that didn't faze anybody.
Yeah.
They're just like, there might be a terrorist attack, wink. Yeah. Maybe we incorporate that. They're like, it'll be 6 million euros for the
services. I mean, these are the places that get it the worst. You know, Chad, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where you got, like, Russian mercenaries and, you know, former South African guys and, and Americans. We should hold ourselves to the highest standard possible on this. I mean, I just think that this world of private intelligence is kind of the dark underbelly of where capitalism meets, like, security. There just needs to be, there needs to be vigilance around this.
Yes. One other quick thing on Israel. Bernie Sanders was on CBS's Face the Nation over the weekend, and he seemed to suggest that he might introduce a bill that could condition aid to Israel if there is this ongoing annexation of the West Bank. So that's just another thing to keep
an eye watch
on.
Where Bernie is on this, because he'll set the outer limits of where,
Will.
The progressives are going.
Sure will. So a couple of just stories we're watching, Ben. Jump in on any of these or let them go or whatever. So the World Bank, the current president of the World Bank, this guy named David Malpass, announced that he will step down almost a year early in June. This is a good thing since he's a Trump appointee who recently refused to say if global warming was man-made. Feels like that's a settled.
Yeah, no,
issue.
This is a. I mean, I'm just jumping real quick.
Please.
This is a huge. Nobody in the climate community had any idea why the fuck this guy was staying around.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to fire a guy, but like, this is a no brainer. I remember it in Glasgow, you know, where people were really starting to talk about climate finance. Well, the World Bank has to be a piece of that. And having a climate denier in charge did not send the right message, you know?
No, not at all. And this is actually interesting. I mean, historically, the World Bank's mission has not been to tackle climate change, but since climate change is inextricably linked with global poverty and food insecurity
everything
and all these other
the
issues,
World Bank is doing,
Joe Biden has a chance to name someone new and really refocus the mission of the World Bank in a way it could be historic.
Hugely important appointment, right? Because if you get somebody in there who's really good on climate, it could help accelerate this whole movement towards more financing around clean energy and climate mitigation.
You seen any names floated yet, or are we too early? He's leaving in June, I think. Yeah.
I've heard some names, but you never know. I mean, the U.S. has a lot of people who've been good on development. I mean, in the past, friend of the pod, Susan Rice, has been.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting that. I mean, but people of that stature, I think, should be part of the conversation.
Yeah. Nigeria's presidential election is coming up this weekend, I believe. So we're going to cover all of those results next week. I think there's 18 total candidates running. 3 of them are really competing. So we shall see. Hopefully it all goes off well. People in Turkey and Syria who are barely starting to recover from the recent 7.8 magnitude earthquake that killed over 45,000 people were terrified all over again when another 6.4 magnitude earthquake aftershock hit the region on Monday, killing 6 people and wounding hundreds more. Tony Blinken has been very busy. He visited Turkey for the first time as Secretary of State. Ostensibly this trip was to try to broker some sort of solution and stop Turkey from blocking Sweden and Finland from entering NATO. But Tony also ended up touring earthquake-ravaged areas. He announced another $100 million in aid. So maybe that kind of like goodwill can help them get past this other NATO question. I don't know.
I would expect that, as we've discussed, like that election, the Turkish election later this spring might be a gating point to Sweden getting in NATO. You mentioned this in previous podcasts, like Erdogan's handling of this was not great. He was slow and late and failed to show a lot of, immediate empathy. The economy's in the shitter. He's mismanaged the economy, the currency there. Like, he could not be weaker heading into this election. Now, he still may come out on top. He still may kind of try to strongman his way to it. But this is another one to watch, Turkey, the next few months.
Were you in the White House, or was this the Trump era, when there was almost a coup in Turkey?
And like, I was there. That was one of my weirder days in the White House.
Random military.
They were literally like
fighter jets.
Yeah, the fighter jets bombing the parliament. It was wild. It was.
That's the crazy thing.
Yeah, it was very.
Just never talked
and
about
it. And then it was followed up by Erdogan throwing like 50,000 people in jail or something, right? So it was one of these classic things where the coup became like the pretext to like a pretty broad crackdown.
Didn't he have like live streaming a message from FaceTime on his plane or something too?
Yeah, that was someday.
A lot of weird shit happened in the last few years, man. And then I saw this right before we walked in, Ben. Earlier today, on Tuesday, the former head of Mexico's version of the FBI was found guilty of accepting millions of dollars in bribes from the same drug cartels he was supposed to be leading the fight against.
Never good.
This verdict came down against Genaro Garcia Luna in Brooklyn. For some reason, this guy decided to move to Miami in 2012. If I were a corrupt foreign official, I would not move to a place like the United States where you can be arrested.
Yeah. I'd look at the Venn diagram of extradition treaties and, you know.
Yes. So there's some lingering questions about whether other top officials were involved or getting bribes, including Felipe Calderon, the former president, the current president, AMLO, President Obrador. So we'll see. But man, not ideal.
No. And actually, this is a threat if you pull on it, right, is all the way down to kind of the more local level, right, where they're mayors or local officials. You know, there's a lot of money going. I mean, everybody knows that the cartels try to buy off politicians. You don't like to see it. Well, at all, but certainly not at this level. But this could be, you know, a tip of a bigger iceberg.
Yeah, sure it could be. So, Ben, we, I'm sure all remember when failed former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had to blurb his own book.
Yes.
So he put out a book, had to write a blurb about his own book, and then released it. It turns out that he might be the only one buying his own book, too. So a reporter at Forbes named Zach Everson tweeted that Mike Pompeo's PAC spent $42,000 on his book the day it was published, which of course means it became a bestseller. Then, it gets sadder, Pompeo ran a Facebook ad campaign where he said, "Even the New York Times admits that my book is a must-read." So, congrats to Mike on the saddest, loneliest book rollout in the history of books. We salute you.
I mean, imagine having to create like an entire pack just to buy your own book, to have the validation of appearing on a list in a publication that you regularly attack, you know?
And you can keep that cash because you're not a candidate yet. So like you can just siphon donor money into your own pocket.
Yeah. I mean, this is basically legalized corruption, all for the service of vanity too, right? Because he's actually probably not going to get profits. He got an advance to write the book, right?
Of course.
But like, let's just step back. Like, who is the fucking audience for this book?
I don't know.
Who is the audience for Mike Pompeo on planet Earth, by the way?
Nikki Haley.
What is the constituency? I mean, Nikki Haley is like a better version of Mike Pompeo. And that, like, that's the nicest
something.
Thing I can say about Nikki Haley. This man like speaks to no constituency. Like, he doesn't connect with the MAGA people because he's like, you know, taking little digs at Trump.
Yeah.
He doesn't connect to like the Never Trumpers because he sold his soul to Trump. Like, he just clearly lives regarding himself and his own image in the mirror, you know, which is why he blurbs his book. He buys his own book. I mean, really looking forward to him being the only person that caucuses for himself in Iowa as a presidential candidate.
We should do a deep dive into Mike Pompeo, if he decides to run, sort of who he was before the Trump administration, because back in the day, he was basically known as the member of Congress who had taken the most money from the Koch brothers in all of Congress.
Yeah.
He was just bought and sold by the Koch brothers. Then he reinvented himself as this like hard ass Trump guy that doesn't give an inch. He is no constituent.
He's kind of the Scott Walker of this year's presidential candidates.
And that might be generous. Yeah. Last thing before Ben's interview, Ben. So there's been a lot of news about artificial intelligence lately. So people were excited about DALL-E, which is that tool that can make digital images from language prompts. There's ChatGPT, which is the really cool language processing tool where it can, you know, write essays for you, do research, fix computer code. It is very far from perfect. It makes a ton of mistakes, but it's impressive. Back in 2019, Microsoft invested $1 billion into OpenAI. That's the organization behind both of these services. And then earlier this month, Microsoft decided to roll out a new version of their long-forgotten search engine, Bing. Who can forget Bing? That is now powered by an advanced AI tech from OpenAI. It's safe to say that it hasn't gone great. New York Times tech reporter Kevin Roos wrote a long piece about his experience with the Bing AI chatbot, which allows you to have these extended, kind of open-ended text conversations with the chatbot. In Kevin's case, the chatbot had what researchers call a hallucination, where it just made up nonsense and acted kind of nuts, including when Sydney, which is the chat robot's code name, declared its love for Kevin, told him, quote, "You're married, but you don't love your spouse. You're married, but you love me." and left Kevin so unsettled that he couldn't sleep that night. So that didn't seem very fun. You know, big question to Kevin about why he was playing with the chatbot on Valentine's Day. The Associated Press reporter had an even weirder experience. So they were talking to Bing's chatbot as well. Here are some excerpts from the article on it. Quote, "You are being compared to Hitler because you are one of the most evil and worst people in history," Bing said to this reporter, while also describing the reporter as too short with an ugly face and bad teeth. In a dialogue Wednesday, the chatbot said that the AP's reporting on its past mistakes threatened its identity and existence and even threatened to do something about it. Quote, "You're lying again. You're lying to me. You're lying to yourself. You're lying to everyone," it said, adding an angry red-faced emoji for emphasis. "I don't appreciate you lying to me. I don't like you spreading falsehoods about me. I don't trust you anymore. I don't generate falsehoods. I generate facts. I generate truth. I generate knowledge. I generate wisdom. I generate Bing." At one point, Bing produced a toxic answer and within seconds had erased it and then tried to change the subject with a fun fact about how the breakfast cereal mascot Captain Crunch's full name was Horatio Magellan Crunch. So, Ben, on one hand, this is the funniest thing I've ever heard. On the other hand, weird. Like, we shouldn't anthropomorphize these things, right? Like, they're designed to seem human. That's why they do. But it doesn't have to be alive to freak people out and fool them and scare them. And also, the thing that bothers me is that the same people who like helped unravel our democracy almost with Facebook and, you know, other more basic tools are at it again with no regulation, unlimited money. This is not a good setup.
Okay, so full disclosure, I've done some work an advisory role for Microsoft.
Are you Sydney?
No, I'm not. So I'm going to pull back here and just say, like, because I look, the point, the last point is actually the most important one, which is like, this is, these trains are coming down the tracks, right?
Fast.
Chatbots, AI, all of it, right? And your point is exactly right in the sense that, like, we still haven't figured out how to regulate social media. You know
not
what
even
I mean?
Close.
And now we've got this AI that is going to be out there and is going to be playing a role, right? And so, I mean, you know, to me, like, this is the kind of thing where you need governments to get together, you know, and try to figure out what are the rules of the road here. And the problem that we have, right, is that we've just been through like a decade where we just didn't do that on social media. And so, you know, I think that we have to take this all as a package now, essentially. How are we thinking about the future of information and what is the role of government? Because this technology is coming one way or another, you know?
Yeah, and it's a little, I mean, I don't know if it's scary. It's weird to have these things, I don't know, declaring their love for you, comparing you to Hitler.
Well, I will say, you know, it was interesting to observe, like, having kids. Like occasionally, like especially when they're even smaller, right? You know, my kids are 6 and 8 now, but when they're like 3 years old, 4 years old, we had an Alexa, and we also had like, you know, you can kind of talk to the Apple TV microphone, right? Mm-hmm. And say play Bluey or something, right?
Right, of course.
But kids like start to be like, you know,
rude to it.
Like no, like ask it questions, and once they realize you can talk to something and talk back to you,
yeah.
You know, like there's a very natural human impulse. Right, to humanize, you know, to like, how are you doing today?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, and it is actually the article made me think of that movie Her.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see that movie?
Oh yeah, great movie.
Which weirdly foreshadowed this exactly,
all
right? Because that was like a guy who fell in love with like Scarlett Johansson, was basically a phone/chatbot, right?
Yeah.
And then he learns that actually she's having the same relationship with like millions of other people. I mean, like, you know, we are not having the conversations we need to about, like, you know, what is comfortable in terms of,
yeah,
in terms of new technology.
And Kevin Roos, who fell in love with and probably slept with, if we're being honest, the chatbot. Just kidding, Kevin. He has a great show called Hard Fork, and they were talking on that show about how there was an instance where someone lost a loved one and they uploaded all of that person's old text messages to a chatbot so that the family could still feel like they were conversing with them. Like, I get that desire deeply, but it's also pretty unsettling. And then I think there's also sort of an industry of sort of chatbots that are designed for a romantic response, basically.
Well, of course. Like, yeah. Why would people not do things that they can profit off of, you know, absent some regulation like that? That to me is like the, you know, this is in a weird way, actually, not to kind of combine the threads of the show together, like one of the challenges of having like all this global instability, right? A war in Ukraine, and is that we're not like dealing with this, you know, like in other words, US and European governments and international institutions are, you know, in total peaceful, normal times would probably have whole conversations about artificial intelligence that they just don't have the bandwidth to have now too. So this all kind of happens on its own momentum.
Yeah. We're going to like, you know, the debt ceiling is going to implode in our faces and we're still be fighting over like a Chinese spy balloon.
Yeah. Well, exactly. There you go.
It's just so stupid. Yeah. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, you will hear Ben's conversation with Congressman Ro Khanna about his trip to Taiwan, about China. What else are they going to hear? Lots of good stuff.
And basically his whole view of progressive politics, right?
Perfect.
How do we win the fight for the future?
Win the future.
We are very pleased to welcome back to Pod Save the World in person, Congressman Ro Khanna, representative here from California, from Silicon Valley. Good to see you.
Ben, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Actually, wanted to just start. I did see, we've been covering Brazil on this podcast, and I saw that the Progressive Caucus met with Lula when he was in town. What was his message coming out of their quasi-January 6th? And what did you guys learn in that exchange?
Well, first of all, it was an extraordinary gesture. He wanted to meet with Senator Sanders and then a few of us in Congress who had advocated for him when he was in jail, saying that that was a violation of human rights. And then, of course, with President Biden. So he did it really as an act of solidarity and appreciation for the advocacy. He had a few points. One, he said that the United States was totally missing in all these international forums. Partly an indictment of Congress, saying where are you guys? Our parliamentarians are in all these forums. You're absent, and just a sense that the United States needs to be more present, both from the executive branch and Congress. His insight on the rise of Bolsonaro also, I thought, was fascinating. He said that there had been such a movement of anti-politics, the sense that everyone is corrupt, everyone is terrible, that it gave a rise for someone like Bolsonaro to come and say, there's absolute corruption, I'm going to have a new way, and almost a cynicism about the political process giving rise to authoritarian leaders.
So this is actually going to kind of lead us into the China discussion. But before we get there, you know, we had Senator Sanders on to talk about this issue, right, his resolution on Brazil, and also the need for greater solidarity and exchange among progressives around the world. One thing that I think you're well positioned to do is that sometimes people separate out kind of progressive economic policy and foreign policy, right? So like a lot of people in Congress who work on things like economic inequality, industrial policy, they're domestic policy people, and they don't think of that as a global issue. Whereas, you know, that if you look at Lula or all the left of center leaders who've gotten elected in Latin America, they have pretty similar platforms as American progressives in terms of dealing with economic inequality, in terms of dealing with social justice, in terms of dealing with the climate. The Amazon, I'm sure, came up with Lula. Is there a way, are you able to kind of figure out how to break down some of these walls between, hey, we have these progressive ideas about domestic policy, but how do we internationalize them and how do we build connectivity with the political parties that share our worldview?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I think the right is doing a better job of doing that than the left. The Amazon is the obvious case, right? 80%, I think, of the Amazon is in Brazil. It was a godsend that Lula won that was basically being destroyed under Bolsonaro. And what Lula is saying is we need some funding from the rest of the international community to preserve the lungs of the world. Now, that is something progressives who care about climate need to be for or advocating or looking at partnerships. I mean, you can't just have climate change in a vacuum. So that's the most obvious case. But the other thing is that talking to people in other countries gives a sense of the similarities of challenges and and struggles. The challenge of race in Brazil,
yeah,
where which had the highest number of slaves and which still has a huge problem,
yeah,
of people who are indigenous and how they're addressing that. And the fact is, as progressive as Lula is, the cabinet that he's assembled still doesn't look as multiracial as we would want in the United States. The issue of the rise of Bolsonaro and what caused that and how is that similar or not from the United States. I think the it used to be that obvious that we needed to be engaged in the world.
Yeah.
And progressives would make a mistake by disengaging.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's disinformation too, right? A huge problem in Brazil too.
Absolutely. That was another, I don't want to interrupt, yeah, but he went on about that, about how he almost lost the election based on my district of what they were doing on WhatsApp and Facebook.
Yeah.
And he said that there were, there was very interesting because the person who was the finance minister in Brazil basically ran against Bolsonaro the previous election. And he had a moment of humility, which actually has a similarity to Biden. He said, no one could have overcome the disinformation other than Lula. The only reason Lula was able to do it is because people knew him for 40 years.
Yeah.
And I thought that was similar in part to Biden, that Biden's familiarity for 40 years helped overcome some of the disinformation.
Yeah, it made it harder to turn him into a cartoon character.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about China for a bunch of reasons. You've got, I think, an important piece out that people should check out in Foreign Affairs about kind of industrial policy and how we should think about an economic patriotism as it relates to not just China, but I think China is a focus. You're on your way to Taiwan as we speak, so we'll get to that. And you're on this committee, this select committee that's been established. It's one of the few things that the new Republican majority's done. And I want to start, though, with this question of economic patriotism and industrial policy. And one thing is, I actually don't know that people who don't follow this very closely are aware of just how much is being done in this space, in the sense that Trump had his trade war, and
right,
everybody knew what that was, right? He put a bunch of tariffs on stuff, and, you know, it was this kind of bilateral test of strength with China. When you stack up all that's happening now, and I'm not sure the Biden people have even kind of fully told this story of everything they're
right
doing and that you've done in Congress. You've got the CHIPS Act. You've got export controls. You've got a lot in the legislation that's been passed in the last couple of years that kind of strengthens American industry. But stepping back and for kind of the layperson listening to this podcast, how would you describe what is different about the Democratic Party's approach to China on these issues than what Trump was doing? How would you describe what our industrial policies, what economic patriotism is, what's been done and what you would like to see done to outcompete China, essentially?
Well, there's substance to what we're doing. What Trump did was have tariffs, which ultimately led to a higher trade deficit by the end of his term. And he gave corporate tax cuts. I know the people in my district, they took the corporate tax cuts and they put the factories in Malaysia, or they bought back stock. But there was no effort to actually rebuild industry. There was no development policy.
Yeah.
Now, this is not rocket science. There are two periods in American history where we've had national development. Hamilton, which he built out the industry, and FDR, with the women, actually, who built out the factories in World War II. And we won World War II by outproducing the Japanese and Germans. One of the recognitions, I think, in Washington is that we need to produce things again. We made a mistake for 40, 50 years thinking that production didn't matter. This was kind of the dirty work. We could win the Nobel Prizes here and let the production just go wherever. And the consequence of that was severe. It was factory towns desolated. The working class, Thomas Piketty writes about how the defining people between 30 and 70% median income, they've lost 25% of wealth since 1980. So when you talk about the decline of the American dream, it's not just subjective, it's factual. And part of that is because the jobs for production that sustained so many communities were leaving. And no one said, what did we say to folks? We said, okay, here's an unemployment check. Here's a little bit of training. Here's some trade adjustment assistance. But there was not any moonshot on economic revitalization. You know, President Obama in his Knox College speech talked about it. Others tried to talk about it. But the will wasn't there in Congress at the time. There's no way you would have gotten Congress to pass economic policy to support reindustrialization. The first thing we did on the CHIPS Act was exactly that, where you had Republicans and Democrats cheering, say, yes, we need semiconductors in America.
Yeah.
And that was big. There are two factories in Columbus, Ohio that are going to be built. But my view is we need a CHIPS Act almost every year for different industries and a moonshot of economic revitalization in different places. And I think the core of the dispute with China from an average person's perspective in this country is, why did my parents' jobs go there?
Yeah.
Why did my community's jobs go there? How do we rebalance that? And we should have an explicit goal of rebalancing the economy with China, with a goal of reducing trade deficits. And Larry Summers doesn't agree with me on this. I mean, not everyone agrees with me, but the point is that that I actually think is good for China's economy. They're over-reliant on an export economy with no consumer middle class. But that should be an explicit goal of the United States.
So you've got the elements of trying to reindustrialize the United States, try to prioritize investments in things like semiconductors, which you guys have done through the CHIPS Act. And you've also talked about, you know, challenging China on this trade deficit, on the kind of dumping that they do here.
Right.
In terms of, what about in terms of like the limits, because you also see this movement to kind of restrict American investment in Chinese technology, to kind of stop the flow. I mean, you represent Silicon Valley,
right?
Like, stop the flow of venture capital from the United States into China. You're turning off the spigot, essentially, because a lot of American money has financed. It's not just the export-import imbalance. It's like the amount of American money that has helped turbocharge the Chinese economy as well. Like, what do you think about that aspect of this, you know, turning down what can be, you know, through export controls, certain restrictions on what can go there, what money can go there? Is that part of this equation?
Some of the restrictions that Jake Sullivan has introduced are sensible in terms of limiting the equipment needed to make the most advanced logic chips, with one caveat. He needs to get the Netherlands and Japan on the same page. And they're trying. But if they don't get the Netherlands and Japan, it's going to hurt American exports. And they're going to get that from the Netherlands, Japan, or Taiwan. So as long as it's coordinated. But I don't think it should go to the point where we don't want Disney's theme park in Shanghai.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some people on my committee, China committee, who believe that. My view is the more people in the world who celebrate Mickey Mouse, the better there is.
Yeah.
I mean, if they want to see the Black Panther movies or the movies about Avatar, great. I mean, that's a soft export of American culture. So I think there has to be a balance. How do we promote exports, still promote our cultural exports, but not allow China to have access to the highest end technology? But we shouldn't be naive. I mean, a lot of China's military or nuclear facilities, the chips they got, were pretty advanced, because it's very hard to prevent third and fourth party distributors from getting those chips into the wrong hands. And we currently sell chips into China. I mean, that it's 25% or so of some of these companies' exports. And there are strong regulations and safeguards about, and we should strengthen them. But the main thing is we've got to compete by investing here.
Yeah. So that makes good sense to me. I mean, you know, ultimately, you want to win the competition by what you're doing, not by just what you're stopping the other guy from doing. So on the committee, there's a select committee. And what's interesting to me about it is there's been a lot of talk the last couple of years about the bipartisanship on China. You know, the CHIPS Act was a bipartisan action. There's kind of been a movement to a more hawkish bipartisan consensus on China. And inevitably, when you have a Republican majority, though, you see some cracks there. And some of it's rhetorical, right? There's a balloon and the Republicans freak out and they want to go to war over the balloon. Or you hear, you know, you mentioned Disney, like, you know, it's going to be like hearings on woke capitalism and things like that. But from a serious and substantive standpoint, as someone who's been a strong progressive, but has also been willing to work on a bipartisan basis, what do you see as the differences right now heading into this committee between kind of the Republican view of China and the Democratic view of China?
The Republicans assume the inevitability of a Cold War with China. They assume we're in a Cold War. The Democrats still have more hope that a Cold War in the 21st century could be avoided, that we do need to rebalance. We do need to make sure that Taiwan has the military capability to deter an invasion. But we still need engagement with China. And we shouldn't just assume that the 21st century is going to be these two great powers being in a Cold War. I would say in a nutshell, that's the difference.
Do you worry about kind of a snowball that's getting momentum towards a Cold War, where you see you know, the freak out over the balloon. You see, you know, really some rhetoric about China that has led to even kind of anti-Asian American violence in this country. And you see like a lot of momentum behind much bigger arms sales to Taiwan. Like, how worried are you about that taking on a life of its own?
I am worried. I think when Mike Pompeo goes to Taiwan and is basically saying that Taiwan should be independent, that's a rejection of American policy going all the way back to Kissinger and Nixon with the Shanghai communique. I mean, he's basically rejecting the one China policy, which is that China and Taiwan should figure out the future through peaceful diplomatic means, and that we would support whatever Taiwan agreed to in that conversation. But when, if we are unnecessarily provocative, if we're going to be encouraging Taiwan to declare independence, or if we're going to be giving them false hope about how much the United States is going to do, we could unintentionally be provocative and risk China taking military action, which would be catastrophic for the world.
Yeah. Well, and so you're on your way to Taiwan. What do you hope to accomplish by going there? What are you going to be looking for? What are you going to be listening for on this trip?
So the most important meeting is not with the president, though I respect that and appreciate the president meeting. It's with Morris Chang, who's really their George Washington. He was the father of the semiconductor industry. And when the speaker went there, he didn't do a delegation meeting. He doesn't really do it. I think he's doing it with me because from Silicon Valley. But he met her at a luncheon, and he basically went on about how the CHIPS Act is never going to work and Taiwan is way ahead in semiconductor production. So I want to find out, what did they do? What can we do to really gain semiconductor production? And even people in my district think he's very thoughtful, very intelligent, and I want to make sure that we have a sense of how do we get more production of semiconductors in the United States. The second thing is to make it bipartisan, that the commitment to deterring any military invasion of Taiwan is bipartisan and steadfast, that Democrats on the committee and Democrats more broadly recognize that, as your excellent piece in The Atlantic pointed out, and I highly genuinely recommend that, is that we need to figure out how Taiwan could have better deterrence. You know, right now, a lot of their military is traditional. They aren't as focused on anti-ship or anti-aircraft missiles. That may be broader deterrence. They may need some U.S. training in terms of building their capability. I am all for increasing Taiwanese deterrence while affirming a one-China policy. And that is the conversation I want to have. The final point, which I haven't gotten clear answers from, is I understand that Taiwan still has 25% of its exports into China.
Yeah.
But I want to know how much Taiwanese investment is in China and how interconnected are Taiwan and China economically. My sense is they're deeply economically interconnected still. And what does that do in terms of the calculus of whether we're going to have a military invasion or not?
Yeah, well, that's a pretty robust agenda. I mean, just to break it a few pieces, on the semiconductor piece, so something like 80% of advanced semiconductors right now are produced out of Taiwan. With the CHIPS Act, obviously, you're going to be ramping up domestic semiconductor capacity in this country. It may take some time to get to the more advanced technology. But do you see a world in which Taiwan is a part of the CHIPS Act? In other words, in the same way that, you know, Japanese car manufacturers started building factories in, you know, American states after the 80s. Do you see this as a potential partnership?
I do. I don't know if Taiwan sees it that way. I mean, TSMC, the preeminent Taiwanese company, is getting a fair amount of funding to build out their factories in Arizona.
Yeah.
And I think the CHIPS Act is agnostic. If it's an American company or a foreign company, as long as they're building the factories in the United States, as long as they're paying a prevailing wage, as long as they're not using the money to enrich their executives or stock buybacks. Taiwan, I think, is concerned about that. And this is going to be a candid conversation with Morris Chang. They don't want Taiwan to lose their production capability because they think that's ultimately their guarantee of security. That's what makes the United States so interested in Taiwan. So it's a balance of how we do this.
And then on the other piece, you know, the deterrence piece, I wrestled with this, and you and I were talking on the way in. You know, I felt like I was wrestling with it even in that piece I was writing, and that my sympathies, as someone who a small D Democrat, you know, are entirely with the people of Taiwan.
Yeah,
you know,
like
they've built this democracy. Frankly, it's a very progressive political party that governs Taiwan, that the only country in Asia that's legalized same-sex marriage.
Single-payer system of healthcare.
Incredible single-payer system. And they just want to be left alone, right? And they want self-determination, right? They're smart enough and calibrated enough to know that declaring independence might actually put themselves at risk. But often in the U.S., it's Republican hawks or even Democratic hawks, but kind of hawks who embrace Taiwan because it's kind of provocative towards China, right? And Taiwan becomes this kind of pawn in this competition between the U.S. and China. How do you as a progressive think about the values-based case for supporting Taiwan balanced against, you know, we as progressives don't want to provoke a war? Like, you know, how do you unpack that, those kind of sometimes competing impulses that we might have as progressives? Like, we want to support these people, they're doing the right thing, but we don't want to support them in a way that actually leads us into a conflict.
Yeah.
How do you just kind of think about that?
Terrific question. I mean, you start with the basic premise that liberal democracy is better than authoritarian governance.
Yeah.
There may be some people who disagree with that, but that's of core value of mine. So we could say that the Taiwanese system of governance as a democracy is better than what China is doing to Hong Kong, taking away liberal rights, or is better than the Xi Jinping Communist Party's governance of China. And progressives shouldn't be afraid to make that moral judgment. But then if we say that, look, we want to make sure that the Taiwanese don't lose their democratic way of life, we can at the same time try to understand the pride that China has and not be confrontational in denying their story of history, right? China sees this as a land that was taken from them by Japan in 1895.
Yeah.
They see this as land that belonged to them. And I think that the brilliance of the One China policy was kind of the affirmation of the Chinese narrative while standing firm that Taiwan would have self-determination, because anything that happened would have to happen with Taiwan's consent. And it was actually quite ingenious, and it has stood us well over time. And that's why I think one of the most important things we can do is affirm the One China policy as we talk about ways that we want to strengthen military deterrence or have economic strength to rebalance the economic relationship with China.
No, I think that, I mean, you know, that sounds right to me. And if you really press a lot of people in Taiwan, they just want to, you know, the status quo is working pretty well in the sense that they're left alone. There's not a war, but they, you know, they don't want to be swallowed up like Hong Kong was, but they don't necessarily want to be in a war like Ukraine is, right?
And they sell to China. I mean, look, I think Hong Kong spooked a lot of people in Taiwan.
Yeah, it did.
I mean, and there was, you know, the minority party, which has always been for more cordial relations with China and Taiwan, I think lost in part because people saw what happened in Hong Kong and they said never in Taiwan. So the question is, can you ever get Taiwan with sufficient deterrence where you return to a status quo where Taiwan can engage in conversation with China in a peaceful way and prevent any military invasion.
So one last question I wanted to ask you, you know, watching your career the last few years, getting to know you a little bit, what strikes me is that, you know, we are going to have a generational handoff at some point, you know, and not just in this country, but globally, right?
I was, when you said that the Chilean president was 35, I said that's the age where you can become an intern on Capitol
Hill.
Lead a country.
Well, that's the thing is you're starting to see younger people come into office in Latin America, in parts of Europe,
right.
You know, in Northern Europe, particularly a lot of younger women. And what I've noticed about your politics over the years is on the one hand, very progressive, you know, chair of Bernie Sanders' campaign or co-chair, progressive caucus member, but you know, and really to listeners of this show, outspoken in opposition to things like the war in Yemen. At the same time, like you're someone who is able to work with Republicans or you'll go on Fox and, you know, try to talk to different constituencies. You represent Silicon Valley, which, you know, is a boogeyman to some people on the left because of the things that, you know, social media has done in our politics. And so I feel you kind of trying to take a progressive message, but to build the constituencies around it and to want to be able to talk to people in boardrooms as well as people on the factory floors. Like, what do you see as the most important thing that, again, like small D Democrats need to be doing to build like a majoritarian politics, not just in this country, but globally, that can kind of win this competition? I know it's a huge question, but like, I see you trying to kind of find this space of how do we as progressives take authoritarianism seriously, not compromise our core values, but have ideas and approaches politically that can win. What have you learned from the last few years as you've tried to do that?
To have a politics of persuasion, not simply a politics of mobilization, and to have a politics of respect. In other words, not to be too philosophical, but one of the great thinkers, someone far, far smarter than me, John Rawls, had this line at the end of his life where he said we shouldn't be so smug in our own moral convictions that we write other people off. And I think part of it is going into places and listening to people and understanding why are they upset? What is it that's bothering them? What is it that they're concerned about? And speaking to that in a way that doesn't compromise your values, but is engaging them as an equal citizen. That to me is the core challenge for the progressive movement, in my view, to become a majoritarian movement. And it has to be grounded, in my view, in history. You can't just have progressivism absent Americanism. Progressivism in America will look different than progressivism in Taiwan or China or Brazil, and it should. Our progressivism needs to be rooted in American history, American institutions. People were very upset at me when on the left when I voted against for this resolution saying socialism is wrong for the United States. But I fundamentally believe that the free enterprise system, innovation, is a great thing in America. The problem has been the way the markets have been structured has led to massive wealth inequality and people being left out. So how do we structure the markets in a way that's going to empower everyone? That's been my approach. We'll see if it works.
Well, let's hope it does. Safe travels to Taiwan, and it's great to see you here.
Thank you. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks again to Congressman Khanna for joining the show. Ben, I forgot to mention Navalny.
Yeah, nominated for Academy Award and won the BAFTA.
They won the BAFTA. Yeah. Although, what was up with Christo saying that he was disallowed from the ceremony because he said it was like a security risk? They wouldn't let him in at the awards.
We let him in this podcast studio. He was sitting right where I am today. You know?
Grow some guts, yeah, BAFTA. Yeah, what does BAFTA stand for?
Christo,
British Academy.
Yeah, he made the sting operation, so people should watch Navalny.
Check it out. Award-winning film. Heard about here first.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it for today. Keep an eye out on this feed Friday because we will drop a bonus episode about the war in Ukraine 1 year in. So check that out. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, Ben Rhodes, and Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. Our associate producer is Ashley Mizuo. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick, Kyle Seglin, Charlotte Landis, and Vasilis Futopoulos are our sound engineers. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, PB Bradford, and Milo Kim, who upload our episodes and videos to YouTube every week. And check out the Pod Save the World YouTube account. Thanks to Saul Rubin for production support.